I really enjoyed reading the Magic Kingdom. I did have a couple of questions about it. I want to ask some questions about you and about your writing and about your background and this sort of thing. But I want to ask a couple of questions also, obviously, about the Magic Kingdom. I jotted down some of the words that you used. I don't know if they're made-up English words or Cockney words, but I thought they were funny because they were dropped throughout the book in the dialogue. Things like locks, bent, dishy, foo-for-all. Is that a real word?
Yes. I got those words from a book of English slang. And I got the book of English slang when I went over to London and took the trip off my taxes as a result of buying this $3 book.
Now you're talking about English slang.
Right.
You go to England a lot?
I lived in England for about a year and a half, once for 10 months and once for 7 months, and that ought to add up to a year and a half. And I do go back. England makes me laugh.
Well, I read somewhere, I think in the publicity material that Dutton sent, that you weren't laughing at the time that you were watching a television broadcast.
No, I wasn't laughing. We were in a hotel, my wife and I, and television was on. I was watching some news program from the BBC, and at the end they were doing the human interest stuff. And this was terminally human interest. There were 7 kids in walkers, wheelchairs, on canes, on all fours practically, at Heathrow, on their way to Florida, and the Magic Kingdom, what they called a dream holiday. It hardly seemed like a dream holiday to me, except for a bad dream. But that's what gave me the idea for the book.
And tears actually came to your eyes.
Indeed.
You were at that time still working in George Mills.
I was. Right? I had a year to go on George Mills. This was in November of 80, and I finished George Mills in November of 81. At the time, as a matter of fact, even though I got the idea for the novel, I thought I wasn't going to write it. Not because the idea was suspect, which it was. I was afraid of being more than I was afraid of, you know, being, you know, manipulating the same kind of tears that BBC had manipulated out of my face. But because I thought I wasn't going to write any more novels. I thought that George Mills would do it, and I'd, like Shakespeare, burn my books. But then, after spending 2.5 months in my retirement, I realized that the only thing I know how to do is write novels. So I dredged up the Magic Kingdom and had a good time writing it. And the rest ain't history.
that's strange. You said you thought George Mills would do it. Now, you won the National Book Critics Circle Award 2 years ago for that. I was there that night when you gave your speech. And was it that you actually thought at that time you had said everything you have to say?
Yeah, and also, I mean, I worked on George Mills for about 6 or 7 years. That's a long time. I mean, it's the literary equivalent, it seems to me, of the Boston Marathon. And I was tired. But all I needed was that 2.5 months rest. And I got untired, woke up, and went back to the bubble machine.
Mm. The bubble machine meaning your
computer. Word processor.
The word processor. The story that you have told in The Magic Kingdom is, of course, about death and dying. And it's the kind of thing that you might consider extremely sad. And there are certainly sad elements to it. There's no question about that. But you've also made it a comedy. There are so many funny things. One of the things that I liked especially was the scene in which George, Eddie Bale, was going to the Queen to pitch for some money, and she writes out a check to him and then tells Eddie that once he's raised enough money to...
Show it around, she says.
Yeah, show it around, then mail the check back.
Yeah, this isn't for keeps. Nothing is for keeps.
That was a very funny thing. It's about death and dying, and yet at the very end of the book, you have your concluding scene actually depicts the act of life.
Procreation, yeah. Between a man who thought he was past it and a woman who never wanted to get it on.
So it ends with a substantial note of optimism.
Not a change of heart, but a turn of heart.
Yeah. Let's go back a ways. You were born in New York City.
And yes.
As a child, you had moved to the Midwest.
Born as a child in New York City.
Yeah.
And I moved to Chicago when my father was sent there by his firm. I was 3 years old. I don't know how old he was.
What did your father do?
He sold costume jewelry for an outfit called Coro.
Did you live in Chicago itself?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What was it like growing up in Chicago of the 1930s and 40s?
Well, I mean, I was a kid. I didn't know I was growing up in Chicago in the 1930s and 40s. I was just a kid growing up. But I suppose it's very much like being a kid growing up in Seville.
Mm-hmm. Was there...
You didn't ask me this, but I didn't much like Chicago until I left Chicago. Now I just love going back to that city. I think it's spectacular from an architectural point of view, from a theatrical point of view. It's a theatrical city.
But I
didn't know this when I was growing up.
City of the broad shoulders, and that would Sandberg referred to it.
Broad shoulders, nice legs.
And the stockyards are no longer there, are they?
No.
It's a shame. It's where do you go and get a good piece of meat?
To a restaurant.
Did you have? Was there a literary orientation in your household as you grew up?
My mother was a fast reader. I think she was the first speed reader I ever knew. But I don't think so, no.
What kind of books did you cut your teeth on?
Well, I know the books I cut my teeth on. The first grown-up book I ever read was Betty Smith's A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, followed by See Here, Private Hargrove by Marion Hargrove, and then a book in the Modern Library, the Kaufman and Hart plays in the Modern Library, and Bennett Cerf's, this is my best, but I don't think it was Bennett Cerf's, Whit
Burnett.
Right, Whit Burnett.
Yeah, I read that. I still have that around the house someplace.
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah, without the dust jacket, and it's been in my family, or I guess my father had it.
But those are the four books I read as a kid.
That was a wonderful book. It was filled with short stories. And
Faulkner was in it, everybody.
Hemingway was in it, yeah. I can't remember what was in it, but I certainly remember the impact that had on me.
Yes, and it had it really did. It, and if I can name an influence, who influenced your own network, Norman Corwin.
Oh, yeah.
I thought Norman Corwin was wonderful. And this is when I was a very young kid. I mean, I was 12 and 13 and 14. See how nicely I count? And that CBS workshop was something that I genuinely... I thought I was listening to poetry.
Were you doing as a youngster in high school or before any sort of writing?
Yes. I mean, I wrote, it wasn't any good, but it was features for the high school newspaper. You see, there's no time that I can remember when I did not want to be a writer.
Well, did you just metabolize this dream?
Well,
this
I was under the mistaken impression that if you wanted to be a writer and you went to college, what you did was major in journalism. I thought that's where, you know, novels and short stories were published. I was kind of a dumb kid. Thanks to a guy named Bill Stringfellow, I'm not working for a newspaper today. He caught me in my freshman rhetoric class and told me, look, you know, what you want to do is become an English major. And indeed it was what I not wanted to do. I didn't know what an English major was. I thought it was somebody in the army. But it's what I had to do in order to start reading. After all, I was a kid who had read, what, four books?
See Here, Private Hargrove.
Right.
Yeah, going into journalism, if that doesn't kill one's ambition to write, nothing will. There have been not too many journalists who have made the transition. I think William Ferguson wrote a highly regarded first novel a year or two ago. He was with the Washington Post. It's called Testing the Current. And William Kennedy,
right,
is an ex-journalist,
right,
who overcame
the Albany guy.
Yeah, the Albany guy. He overcame all of the journalistic bad habits. My high school yearbook, 1955, reads Ambition Writer, and so I was beaten out as editor of the high school newspaper, and they made me sports editor, which is an area of humanity that I happen to loathe. But I did it, and to make matters worse, even later I had to produce a television sports show for John Mackey, who apparently was a quarterback for the Baltimore Colts and was sponsored by Coke. So it's these are the kinds of things that really cut into one's literary ambitions.
Right. Accidents shape life more than intentions.
Pardon me?
I say accidents shape life more than intentions.
What? Tell me about college. You were an English major in college.
Forever.
Yeah,
I went to the University of Illinois, cradle to grave. I got my B.A., M.A., and Ph.D. there, and then went on to become a college teacher myself, as I still am.
At, of course, you were writing during this period as you were going to school, I would assume.
I was taking all the writing. I mean, once I got, pointed in what turned out for me to be the right direction, I took all the creative writing courses I could, not because anybody can teach anybody else how to write, but because somebody can provide you with a critical intelligence, a deadline, and a sense that you're not the only person in the world doing this thing.
Your first novel came about through some help from your mother.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, I was finishing my dissertation. I was already teaching at Washington University in St. Louis, and it was the hottest summer in the history of the world. I was doing the footnotes and driving not only myself crazy, but everybody around me crazy. And my wife said, "Why don't you go on a vacation?" And I said, "It takes money to go on a vacation." She pointed out that my mother had money. I made the phone call. She took me to New York, and on the way back, she said, "I thought you wanted to write. I thought you wanted to write novels." I said, "I do." "Well, why don't you do it? I've got a family to support." She said, "Well, I'll support your family the next year. What's your salary?" I told her my salary, and she gave me a raise, and asked me if, I wouldn't take the money and run off and do a novel. And I had, I think, the character to say, "Sure."
That novel was Boswell.
Right.
1964. That novel, did you approach this early venture in any way different than you approached George Mills, certainly a more ambitious project, or The Magic Kingdom?
In a kind of way, that novel set the pattern for me, because I began with the notion of vocation. In Boswell, Boswell is a professional wrestler, and something really very alien to my own experience. But all of the people in my books do things that I have not done myself, and the things they do become sort of metaphors for, central metaphors in the books. I mean, I've written about a radio announcer. I've never been a radio announcer. I've written about a bail bondsman. I've never even been to jail. And a department store owner, a novel called A Bad Man. A franchiser in The Franchiser.
You have spent virtually your entire career in St. Louis.
Indeed, and if my luck holds, I'll be able to spend the rest of it there, too. I love St. Louis.
What's it like being a writer in St. Louis, which has a reputation of being a very depressed area?
Where did you get this reputation, depressed?
I read the New York Times.
Well, you're taking the wrong paper then.
I saw a story on television once.
It's not a depressed area. As a matter of fact, St. Louis is one of the Didn't they just didn't Rand and McNally come out with a rating of cities? Well, St. Louis is number 7 out of the 200 and some odd cities that they rated.
Well, I see.
That's fairly high up on the list.
The St. Louis booster,
indeed.
The literary community.
I sound like Babbitt, but it's true. I mean, it's as they say on the signs, a nice place to raise children.
Well, I worked in Baltimore for about 4 years, and people would always knock Baltimore because it's overshadowed by Washington to the south and New York to the north. But I thought Baltimore was a wonderful city, so like you in St. Louis, I would always come to its defense, and I think there is more to it today than most people give it credit.
I mean, this afternoon I've been in a lot of taxi cabs in New York. It seems to me, although it's certainly, you know, the capital of the world, seems to be sort of the visual equivalent of din. Noise. That doesn't happen in St. Louis.
It's because everybody's moved out.
Nobody's moved out. Come on.
That city is down to, what, 450,000, 400,000 people from nearly a million? And you say people have not moved out?
Yeah, but they live in the surrounding areas. It's got a population of about 1.5 million. It's one of the biggest markets, radio markets, in the country.
Well, CBS has a station there, so
right.
It can't be doing too badly. The literary community, if there is one in St. Louis, I would imagine it's built pretty much...
You're trying to pick a fight with me.
No, I'm not.
Is Howard Nemiroff? Is William Gass?
I'm sorry, who was the first?
Howard Nemiroff?
Yes.
William Gass? Mona Van Dyne, who won the National Book Award for her book of poems? Donald Finkel? Constance Erdogan? I'm not going to name everybody, but there are a whole bunch.
Let me ask you a little bit about multiple sclerosis, because this is a disease that you...
Questions I can answer.
Contracted, yes. You contracted the disease. Tell me about when you contracted this disease, and I know that it has affected you physically, but certainly not mentally. And tell me a little bit about
sure,
how that has altered your life.
It's affected me mentally. I think I go around saying St. Louis is a good city. Of course it's affected me mentally. No, the disease was diagnosed when I was living in London in 1972. As a matter of fact, it was diagnosed on May 15th, 1972. I finished my book, Searches and Seizures, on May 14th of that year. If it had been diagnosed on the 13th, I would never have finished the book, because I went into the only depression I've ever had in my life. I had a kind of reactive depression when I was told I had MS. I didn't know what MS was. I just pictured guys going from an upright position into the gutter by the time you count three. Now, that didn't happen. This was 1972. It's now 1985. And I'm still... in an upright position.
What does it do? I know that it cripples one and makes it difficult, as you have shown, to get around. You have to use a cane. Is this what... I don't really know very much about the disease, and it's probably something I should, but I...
No, you don't want to know about the disease. I've said somewhere else that, you know, it's a dopey disease. It kills you by yards, but you suffer by inches. In other words, it's not going to kill you. Maybe I said it the other way around. But it's a terrible inconvenience.
Is it a painful disease?
No, there's no pain involved.
It would not be surprising, then, for you to write something like The Magic Kingdom.
Yeah, I'm the senator from death.
The what?
I'm the spokesman for death, the senator from death.
Mm. Well, I don't know about that. What do you mean you're the spokesman?
Well, I mean, as I look back on the last few books, I mean something like The Living End, where the world, the whole universe gets annihilated, and in The Magic Kingdom where you know, some children either get annihilated or are going to. There has been a kind of bleakness of vision which I detect in my own work, though it's counterbalanced by a kind of comedy.
Do you live near the campus?
Well, I live right across the street from the campus.
So you can get around to the campus?
Well, actually, Joan drives me onto the campus now. This is what I mean by, you know, suffering by inches. After the disease was diagnosed, I walked to the campus. A little later, I sort of stumbled to the campus, and I drove to the campus and parked my car and walked on into the building. Now I drive on the campus. Cops don't like that too much, but it's either that or I stay home.
Well, you're not staying home. You've been traveling. You've been in England, and you've come to New York, and I assume other places, too. So you have not allowed MS to keep you at home, have you?
No. No, and I'm not going to.
Tell me about, are you teaching creative writing?
Triumph of the Human Spirit, I am. Am I teaching creative writing? Yes.
Yes. As opposed to other elements of
English. As opposed to not teaching creative writing. No, I teach creative writing to, we have a writer's program at Washington U. And graduate students who will get their MFAs and hopefully go on to do their own writing.
You've been teaching writing for a long time, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Have you noticed any, are the students who are in your classes today different at all from the students?
Well, right now, I have the best student I've ever had in my life. I don't think, you know, that I can teach creative writing, though I do it as badly or as well as anybody else. I don't think anyone can teach creative writing, really. But we do supply an awfully good, you know, hothouse in which talent can grow its own self. So this boy, he's a young man, really, John Connolly, who, you know, will be a super writer. He's already an excellent writer, but will make a name for himself. I mean, I know he will. Got there without my help. He came in knowing. And he's gotten better, yes. But he's gotten better because practice finally does make, if not perfect, makes for, you know, damn good.
Did I hear you just say that you cannot teach creative writing?
No, of course not.
What do you do? Inspire?
I listen. I mean, I'm like a kind of literary psychiatrist. I listen to the stories. I read the stories. And I point things out which, you know, go afoul of my own aesthetics. And presumably mine are the right aesthetics, although, you know, you get an argument about that. And then I try to tell the kid, this is weak, this is strong, do this, don't do that.
Didn't your friend and colleague William Gass once accuse you of bullying your students?
Well, that's the rap, but I don't think I do bully my students.
But you're not necessarily gentle with them.
No, I'm not gentle with them. I'm honest with them.
Can't you be gentle and honest?
I don't. I think that's kind of a contradiction in terms. I don't like anybody to be gentle and honest with me, because I always hear the but.
I had a creative writing professor.
The gentility.
I had a Hollis Summers is a novelist. And he's
right. His brother was my boss for a long time, Joe Summers.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he was the head of the English department when I went to Washington U, and I know who Hollis is.
Well, Hollis, I took Hollis's creative writing course in 1955 at Ohio University, where he was teaching for 1 year. He was had taken a leave of absence from the University of Kentucky, I believe, to teach there. He's I think he's semi-retired now, but he went back to work full-time at Ohio University. But he would write things, and my stories were dreadful. I mean, they're horrible stories as I think about them. Adolescent short stories. But he would write things like this. If it came to a line or a paragraph, he would write, "This pleases me." Or there would be another paragraph, and he would write, "I can't hear."
That's as good a way of doing it as any. That's a lovely way of doing it. The best teacher I ever had, it's kind of a toss-up between George Skoufis, who taught me creative writing at the University of Illinois when I was an undergraduate, and Randall Jarrell, a very wonderful poet, and I think a fine novelist, though he only wrote one novel. And he was the kind of guy who said, you know, "This pleases me." What else can you say to somebody? You point out the beauties, as Sam Johnson liked to say. That's the function of a critic. Point out the beauties and
sometimes
point out the uglies.
Yeah, sometimes the truth hurts. When you have generally received very good reviews for your books, but I would imagine that a writer who works hard and finds himself criticized, I think that unless he's very professional or has an alligator skin, I imagine it's very tough.
Yeah. Well, it's still tough.
I was talking to William Styron a while back, and he had a review of John Gardner had reviewed his book Sophie's Choice, which was on the front page of
that
New York.
It was the New York Review of Books, wasn't it?
No, it was the New York Times.
Okay, I don't remember that.
Well, anyway, Gardner took the book apart and didn't like it. I read that review. I had happened to like Sophie's Choice, and I was surprised that Gardner had done that. Recently, a small publishing house in Boston put together a collection of critical essays about William Styron. Styron called this to my attention. And he called Gardner to ask if he could use the review of Sophie's Choice, even though it was highly critical of Sophie's Choice. And Gardner said, "Of course you can use the review of Sophie's Choice, provided you run an afterword in which I repudiate the review because I now think Sophie's Choice is a masterpiece." And Styron, he said, "I can't figure that out." Here he took my book over the coals, and I don't know if it hurt sales or not, but it hurt me that he did that. And then two, three years later, he recants and says he was wrong.
Yeah, well, it's not an untypical story about John. I haven't heard that story, but it's not untypical of John to do something like that.
In fact, I had Gardner here quite a while back, and he said that everything he wrote in Moral Fiction, he said, in effect, he said, "I'm sorry, I wrote that book." He said, "I think now, after reappraising my position, I was wrong in most of my assertions." I don't know if he meant that or if he's just being politic.
As a matter of fact, when you say the word politic, you're using the operative word. At Breadloaf, in the last year of his life, I was there that summer also. He was to give a what they call a craft lecture. And he came for his craft lecture a little bit late. They had to wake him up. And he said, "You expect me to talk about moral fiction? I'm not going to talk about moral fiction. As a matter of fact, I'm not even going to talk about literature. I don't believe in literature anymore. I believe only in politics." And this created quite a stir. But that's what he was. He was kind of a professional stir creator.
Yes, I think he was. And he certainly made news, at least within the literary community. He certainly did that. Well, we've been talking for quite a while, and to kind of wrap things up, you obviously did not retire after George Mills. You went on with The Magic Kingdom. I guess you're still at your word processor working on still another.
I am. The Rabbi of Lud.
The Rabbi?
Of Lud, L-U-D. Lud is supposed to be Lodi, New Jersey. Lodi, New Jersey is a town I'm saying this badly. Lodi, New Jersey, is a cemetery with a kind of town attached to it. And there are a whole gang of folks, including my own grandparents and parents, who were buried in Lodi. God knows why. A lot of people from the East find themselves dead in Lodi. And I'm writing a novel about a rabbi who buries these folks. And I'm trying to keep it comic.
And yeah, another novel about death and dying.
I'm trying to...
We'll probably be able to laugh at it.
To stop being the spokesman for death.
Oh, I had one other question I want to ask you. Dutton was a while back taken over by, I believe...
NAL.
NAL?
Yeah.
I thought it was Thomas Nelson.
No, it was NAL.
The Bible publisher?
It's NAL. The
wasn't Dutton?
Publisher.
Okay. You sure it wasn't Dutton? Which publishing house did Nelson take? What was it?
I think it's Dodd-Mead.
That's right. Okay, I'll withdraw the question. I was going to ask that's right, it was Dodd-Mead. When Dodd-Mead was taken over, they decided to clean up the act editorially, and there would be no references, negative references to Christ or God. You could not say a goddamn, something like that. And I didn't notice anything like that in this, and so I was wondering if Dutton had liberalized its editorial policy, but since that doesn't apply. So on that foolish note, I'll end, and I want to thank you very much for coming in. You're easy to talk to. I have a little worried after I read that you bullied your students. But
you see, bad rap.
But it was all right.
Besides, you're not my student.
That's, yes, I am your student, because every time I read someone who writes as well as you do, I benefit and I learn from it. And so if I'm not just a casual reader, I am indeed your student.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for talking to me.